Thank you. Well, first of all, thank you for the kind invitation and enjoying this beautiful campus and scientific activities. So the subject of my talk will be on the standard Casimir forces between metallic plates, I mean the historical case, but with a special emphasis on the role of thermal fluctuations in this system. Now, the work I'm reporting is essentially contained in these three papers that have been jointly written with Pascal, who is here. It doesn't change the... I don't know, it's not usual to go to the next slide. Do I have to use the... It's a PowerPoint. Ah, this one. Yeah, okay. I took the wrong. Sorry. So let me recall probably everything what I'm going to say to you in these first slides is simply basics and well known to everybody. But nevertheless, to introduce the question I will treat in the talk, I think it is useful to just remind a few things. So the standard calculation of Casimir forces between two metallic plates in the calculation by Casimir and many calculation in textbooks, the plates are treated as macroscopic bodies, that is in fact mathematical surfaces on which one implements the metallic boundary condition for Maxwell equation, that is vanishing of the tangential electric field on the plates. This situation, just to have a name, I will refer to it as having dead conductors, that is mathematical surfaces. And I simply recall the fundamental Casimir's result for the force at large separation at zero temperature, which is the well-known formula that, in fact, force decreases as a force power of the distance. In fact, the important point is the calculation of the coefficient, because you can check that with h bar c and d, it is the only quantity that you can form that has a dimension of the force per unit surface. Now, let's come to temperature. Let me recall also, when we have dead conductors, how do we calculate the effect of thermal fluctuations? As soon as we have a non-zero temperature, we have a new length, which I call the thermal wavelength of the photons. Beta is the inverse temperature. And from this length, we can form a new dimensionless parameter, which is the ratio of the photon wavelengths to the plate separation. And then one can distinguish two regimes if this number alpha is very, very high. And this corresponds to a limit, a joint limit, corresponding either to low temperature, that is beta very big, or temperature very small, and d very small, or the other regime, high temperature or large distances, when d is small and beta is also small, or one of them is small. So when you want to include thermal fluctuation, well, that is a standard thing. One calculates the partition function for quantum harmonic oscillator associated with the modes of the electromagnetic field. One take now the free energy by unit surface of the plates, and the derivative of this quantity with respect to the distance, I call it radiation pressure, is the part that comes from thermal fluctuations. So The total force will be the radiation pressure between the plates, the radiation pressure coming from outside, from semi-infinite space, which has to be subtracted, plus the vacuum fluctuations. Now, we can look at the asymptotics for this formula in the two regimes that I have mentioned, and first take the low temperature, small distance regime. In fact, the radiation part, it's a radiation part within a very very thin black body. It is exponentially small in this parameter, so it plays no role if one just looking at power-like large distance effect. So in fact, the total force at low temperature is the Casimir force, just a correction coming from some infinite space radiation pressure, plus exponentially small corrections. Okay, that's not the regime that will be of interest in my talk. I take the other regime, large separation and high temperature. In this case, the internal radiation pressure as a first term, which is in fact the black body radiation pressure, T to the 4, it has a term which I qualify of classical, because you see it doesn't depend either of the Planck constant nor of speed of light. And wonderfully, there is a next term in D to the 4 that cancels exactly the vacuum fluctuation force of Casimir, because it has the opposite sign. So if you add up everything, you obtain the high temperature long distance asymptotics of the form. It is this term. Now, this has been subtracted out by the pressure from outside. This has been cancelled by the vacuum fluctuations, or quantum fluctuations, and the rest is simply exponentially small. So this asymptotics is, as I mentioned, I qualify it as classical, because it doesn't depend on quantum mechanical effect, called Planck's constant. And in fact, it is entirely, you can figure that it is entirely due to thermal fluctuations because of this cancellation. And the question is about the validity of this asymptotic formula. I have put a little red square around 4, because this one force will be, so to speak, at the center of my consideration and of the debate.
Can I just ask a question here?
Yeah, sure.
So the way you calculate this, you have the Casimir-like electromagnetic field fluctuations, but at finite temperature. This
yes, 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 yes.
So Casimir would be T equals zero, but here you just
well, sum over that's a question of use of Casimir. I use Casimir rather broad sense. Mm-hmm. Right. That is fluctuations, forces induced by fluctuation, both from quantum mechanical nature in the ground state and thermal. And the subject of my talk will be really to understand the interplay between these two sources of the Casimir force.
But the way it's done technically, you just take the eigenfrequencies.
Yes, technically, yeah, you take the boundary condition modify the frequency spectrum of the field,
right.
Depending on the distance, and then you treat these new modes, I mean, yeah, constrained mode, according to the laws of thermal equilibrium of quantum oscillators.
So you don't take just the zero point energy, but you take the complete form.
Yeah, or yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
Now, of course, this is a kind of primitive theory because, as I said, the conductors are dead. They have no internal fluctuation. But of course, there is the famous Lipschitz theory that provides an improvement on that. And just to few words about that, but this is well known to all of us. In the Lipschitz theory, when it's still the two plates, but now they are characterized by frequency-dependent dielectric function that embody the material structure of the plates. One assumes that the polarization field as an average polarization plus a fluctuating random polarization due, which is generated by all kind of fluctuation that you can imagine on in this world, that is both quantum and thermal. So the spirit is really like the Langevin theory. You have an average motion around which you have fluctuation induced by microscopic fluctuation of the system. So you have in that case stochastic Maxwell equations that you can solve, and this gives the basis of the theory. But to introduce the temperature, you assume that you have delta correlated kind of white noise, random polarization fluctuations, that you postulate the fluctuation dissipation theorem, which will relate the fluctuation of the random force to the response, the way that the dielectric function come in. Now, in Lipschitz theory, one can study all the kind of limiting case. And in particular, the one which interests us is to go to the perfect conductor limit. That is, letting, as in macroscopic electrostatic, the dielectric function at zero frequency tends to infinity. Lipschitz, in his paper, finds in this limit that the large distance force is given by the same formula as before, but in the square, in the red little box, that is 8, not 4. And that was historically the source of an immense debate. Probably you have heard of it, but that was exactly the problem that Umar Mohiuddin mentioned at the beginning of his talk. Now, the problem comes from the fact that Lipschitz is well constructed, well structured to deal with dielectric matter, but when you go to metallic limits, you have now freely moving charge. You have also current loops and all kind of new phenomena, and it is there is an ambiguity how you go to this limit. In fact, just historically, I give you a comment that was provided by Schwinger, Dorard, and Milton in their paper, who redid, according their way, version of the Lipschitz theory, and were shocked about the 1/8, and thought that Lipschitz was wrong, but not very serious wrong. It's just a little question. He was not quite careful taking the conductor limit. So he wrote, that's in the paper, they wrote this. And they argued for the 1/4, not for the 1/8. Now, nowadays, one has a more precise understanding of this problem, which I still summarize. As I said, the problem comes from how to go to the infinite dielectric constant in the Lipschitz theory. And according to current proposals, one can take two forms. The Drude, that's the asymptotic for large frequencies, so that's the most diverging term. The Drude model, which includes dissipation or finite conductivity, or the plasma model, which includes only the free plasma oscillations, are two possibilities. Now, if you plug that in Lipschitz theory, one or the other of these two functions, you find different results, unfortunately. If we are in the low temperature, small distance regime, one find the Casimir, in both cases, one find the Casimir term as dominating the situation, so that's okay. And both regimes, that is Drude model or plasma model, correspond in terms of reflection coefficient of transverse electric mode to having them this coefficient 1 order or 0. So one can discuss also in terms of these coefficients. But the situation is less pleasant if we come to the other regime, because if one uses the so-called plasma model, one finds 1/4. But if one uses the Drude models, one finds 1/8. So we are not really out of the problem. So that was a motivation for us to come to hopefully definite decision about that and to undertake a more microscopic theory which doesn't use Lifshitz theory at all, at least to determine these asymptotics. Of course, you can imagine that in a fully microscopic theory, it's hard to calculate too much exactly. But if, yes?
Just as a simple question, as a spectroscopist, a metal has a Drude metal peak and it has a plasma oscillation and it's...
Sure. So, I think these models are very simplified. And probably I'm not aware of all the literature on this question. Maybe one has tried with more realistic forms of the dielectric function. And also you notice that in this form, the dielectric function is not taken as temperature dependent, but I mean, there is no reason for which it should be temperature independent, especially if the temperature is not too small. So,
but for your research, you're only concerned in the leading dielectric.
Leading term. I will comment about the other terms.
There are oscillations. There
okay, are no. No, I will comment later on possible corrections, but I'm only interested in one or the other of these leading terms and to decide safely without, well, you will judge if you want to question the result. That's your that's your job in this talk, but we feel that we have safely decided. Okay, and I will show how. No, yeah.
So your answers to the plasma and Drude models don't have sigma and omega p, so I assume they would enter the range of applicability of these results, the conditions for them. So I wonder if
I think. Well, I don't know if somebody in the audience has.
You have a mixture of both. As long as you have the one over omega pole at zero, is it probably?
Yeah, that dominates the result. I mean, we can have.
The plasma thing's a high frequency form.
So that doesn't cure the problem.
You can get from one to the other, can't you, by putting omega squared on the right hand equation to omega and omega minus one.
Yeah, you can make all kind of phenomenological model interpolating between both with the temperature. But that's a little bit, ad hoc things to my feeling.
Omega, it will be one over omega again at the origin, and that dominates. That makes result.
Now, I would be happy to learn if someone or in some papers that
is... There's one suggestion by, Kimmich, by Geyer. Yeah, Kimmich. Yeah, okay. And Geyer out of the last Leipzig conference, Journal of Physics A, I think.
Yeah.
So is it issue of simple pole versus second order pole?
But maybe a second order pole, I think.
If the debate is settled by a proper prescription, I would be very happy to learn it now. But I'm not sure. I've not seen a lot of proposal, but nothing which is grounded in first principles. So let me come to our model. So that's our goal, decide on the one-half factor without resorting to Lifshitz theory. So we go to a fully microscopic theory, and now I will show you the model that we are using. What are two principles that probably nobody can contest very seriously? Quantum electrodynamics of non-relativistic particle. Of course, I avoid every high energy, all high energy processes, pair creation, all these kind of things. So I take quantum electrodynamics, of course, which is by nature relativistic, but the matter will be non-relativistic. Second, we assume that the prescription of Gibbs works, that is, it's equilibrium, pure equilibrium stochastic. So there will be no dynamics in the Stokes at all. And so we have our system consists of our two plates containing mobile charges. And I will not be make a very precise model, but you can think that these charges as, for instance, mobile electrons in a gallium system. They represent the conducting part of the metal. Of course, the whole metal is not described, only the electron gas. But it can also consist of ion and positive and negative charge, like you find in electrolytes or maybe other semiconductors or hole and electrons or in other system. So, okay, so we have two plates of the surface of the plate is L square, and they have some finite width, A. The two plates are embedded in a larger box that contains the photons. And that's a standard electromagnetic field. The field can penetrate the boxes, of course. And I will give you now the Hamiltonian and the more precise ingredients of the model. So this situation I qualify as living conductors now. So let's come to the 2 point, electrodynamics. So the very basic Hamiltonian that will govern the whole system is the Hamiltonian of non-relativistic particle coupled to the magnetic, to the transverse field, the vector potential, the electrostatic part, and possibly an external potential which is needed to confine the particle in the slabs. And of course, we have the free photon field, H radiation. Now, the gauge, one has to choose a gauge, and it is the so-called transverse or radiation gauge. We separate, which is very convenient, and separate clearly the Coulomb part from the dynamical part, I mean the photon part, which is contained in the vector potential, which has divergence free. And here you read that textbook formula for the free field. This is the vector potential in a finite box that has orthogonal polarization vector to the k, to the propagation of direction of propagation. And we take periodic boundary condition on the big box here. Maybe one has, of course, to specify boundary condition. One take for the field boundary periodic boundary conditions. In fact, for the particle, it turns out that in fact, we'll take Dirichlet boundary condition, that is the wave function of the particle are required to vanish on the sides of the box. Okay, so I think that should be familiar. I mean, I think one cannot object against this Hamiltonian. This Hamiltonian governs all non-relativistic matter in principle interacting with photons. Just a word, to avoid high energy processes, one is obliged to introduce an ultraviolet cutoff that cuts the high value of energy photons at this typical value MC over H bar, which is in fact very, very high, much higher than any typical frequencies that leaves the conductors. Okay, now come to statistical mechanics. So basically, we have the free energy of that system, which is the trace of the Hamiltonian. The trace is taken on all degrees of freedom, that is, on the particles that lives with wave function in some Hilbert space, and on the photons that live in the Fock space of photons. So it's a joint trace. Here it's convenient to normalize or to subtract out the pure black body partition function, which doesn't depend on the distance. And the quantity that I'm willing to calculate is defined as follow. I take first for the finite system, the force, which is defined as minus the derivative of the potential by unit surface. First, I extend the box containing the field to the whole universe, so there is an electromagnetic field living everywhere. And second limit, I take infinitely extended plates in this direction, but keeping a finite length. Otherwise, you have boundary effects that are very difficult to calculate. Okay? Now, just a comment, because now in the microscopic situation, we have various lengths. There is the cutoff length, which is very, very, very small. There is a de Broglie length, because the temperature is not zero, there is a de Broglie length of particles, lambda matière, lambda mat. There is the wavelength of the photon. And finally, there is the phase separation. So I will work in the hierarchy of lengths that are organized as follows. That is, I suppose that the temperature is high enough to have the photon wavelengths larger than the de Broglie lengths of particle in the plates. And that's quite possible, because this grows as square root of temperature, and this grows linearly, so we can always have the situation fulfilled. And of course, the plate separation is itself macroscopic. So this is maybe of the order of microns. This is maybe of the order of a few angstrom or hundred of angstroms. And we have, of course, this will be the strict asymptotic, so D will be very large. Also, the plate should not be too thin, so that screening mechanism can take place in them. So they are also macroscopic. I immediately go to the result, I comment the result, and I will later explain you how one can calculate this force. Well, we find that as D at fixed temperature in the range that I just described, as D goes to infinity, we find that the force, defined as before, behaves with a 1/8 factor. This is an exact result. I mean, in the calculation, there have been no intermediate models, approximation, dropping terms, anything. It just follows from the two principles and the mathematical object, Hamiltonian and free energy, that I've given to you. Of course, there is a reminder, which is decays a little bit faster, which contains now Planck constant and speed of light and other quantity pertaining to the metals. Now, before going to the derivation of the formula, I want to make a few comments. First of all, as noticed in the dead calculator, dead conductor calculation, the force is independent, the dominant terms of Planck constant and speed of light. This is now, to my sense, a highly non-trivial result. If you start with dead conductor, you have put no structure, so no, there is no surprise to find no parameter, microscopic parameter pertaining to the metals. But here we have put everything. So it's a kind of miracle that the prefactor doesn't depend on type of charge, mass, chemical structure, densities, anything you can consider as characterizing a metal from another one. So we'll understand later how it happens. Now, the factor is definitely 1/8 and not 1/4, and I will comment this accord.
This was
1/8 was the factor for the Drude model in the high temperature limit. And this was the factor for the plasma model.
Why should the plasma model actually describe these large distance regimes?
No, this is, I don't know. I mean,
which does it agree with again? This exact formula agrees with which?
I come back maybe to the.
Or of a Lifshitz calculation.
I come back to the Lifshitz calculation.
The
okay. So this corresponds to this case. If you plug in Lifshitz theory the Drude formula and take then the large distance, you find 1/8.
Yeah, but I see the plasma model is a model for high frequencies.
But I don't know. I mean,
it is. It's a symptomatic.
One can continue the debate, but what I
omega is omega plus ion tau instead of omega squared. You can see that that's the high temperature limit, and you recover the other limit as you push it back in omega naught. So you just replace omega squared by the Merman prescription for putting and damping in a correct and Stirling way.
The problem is that at low temperature, at our short distances, the experiments seem to rule out the second possibility, that is. And if one assumes that the same would hold at high temperature, then... But okay, maybe.
I think you debate, but my point of this talk is to show at least a fixed point of that thing, that is.
But I think it's also true if you have a 1 over omega squared correction. I mean, if you take the fluid rooted model, mm-hmm. I mean, it would be still the 1/8.
That's putting in the damping is something to do with irreversibility or with the limits as things go to infinity. I wonder. If it's something to do, needing the Drude type model, is something to do with the limit as the size goes to infinity?
I can only refer you to maybe 100 papers that discuss all these issues and also connection with the Nernst theorem and all that. I'm not sufficiently informed of all the proposals, all the discussion to argue at the level of Lipschitz theory, but I can argue on the microscopic model that is 1/8 if you accept the fundamentals. So I come back to the... Yeah, so I think it's hard to object. Against this result. You can object against my calculation. I made a mistake, but we have done that 50 times to be sure that we don't miss a 1/2 factor. Okay. You can also argue that maybe the Hamiltonian is not the one that we would like to have, but it would be foolish, I think. You can argue that it's a non-equilibrium problem, but then how you define the temperature? So, okay. Now, the prefactor here doesn't involve anything about the microscopic detailed constitution of the plates of the metals, and finally, the calculation doesn't require any regularization procedure. It is completely defined from the very beginning. Now, you have subdominant terms that we are unable at the moment to calculate, but with energy one could do something. It starts looking how the next term involves quantum mechanics and possibly a specific property of the metals principle. So what is the conclusion of that? That in the dead conductor calculation, particle fluctuation in the metals were not included, and one found one force. So we must conclude that particle fluctuation inside the conductor account for reducing the Casimir force from 1/2, at least in the asymptotic regime.
Particle fluctuation seems now the charge-carrying particles.
Yeah. That's the difference between dead and living conductor in my language.
But how can you say that? Because the particles do not, as you said, it's a universal form.
Yeah.
The particles don't really enter explicitly.
But that's but this has to be shown. I mean, if you make a dead conductor calculation, this is given by you at the very beginning because you have put no microscopy. But if you do a fully microscopic, you have to show that the result is universal. And that's how it's non-trivial. How do you have all the complexity of the degrees of microscopic degrees of freedom in the model. So I will show you physically why this coefficient doesn't depend if it's gold, nickel, or aluminum, or if you have a little bit of patience. But a conclusion also is that all calculation of Casimir force based on microscopic boundary condition, mathematical surfaces, cannot be correct, physically correct, not adequately, mathematically, but physically right, when the temperature is not equal to zero. Because there is always an effect which is maybe for intermediate. You see, 1/2 is not a small correction of 1. So if you take an intermediate temperature, you will have also an effect which is maybe not exactly 1/2, but which is there and which is not a small correction. Except maybe going to zero temperature. Now, let me go a little bit to show you how one can calculate, obtain this result. Now I will show you the mechanism, because you know calculations are always boring to see on the blackboard on, and very long and so on. But I will just exhibit the basic mechanisms that enter in the calculation. To simplify the presentation, I will even allow myself to take a purely classical system. I call it the statistical theory of classical Casimir forces, of classical Casimir effects. So I take the same system as before, two slabs with now classical particles that can move, separated by distance d with some thickness, but no photons, no, there is no big box with electromagnetic field. So the only interaction which is present here is simply the basic Coulomb interaction between. Now, you may object that this is very remote from Casimir ideas, because in fact there is no more there is only the static part of the electromagnetic field. But you will see why this model is relevant, in fact, a little bit later. It's of course much easier to calculate in this model. No, I have to go far. Okay, so how, now this is a purely equilibrium statistical mechanical problem in a system which is inhomogeneous, because you have matter in two slabs and not uniform matter. So what are the energies? You have the particle in the first slab, you have the particle in the other slab, and we have the mutual Coulomb interaction between the two slabs. That's the only energies, only interaction that are present in this model, okay? And you have a Gibbs weight, which is simply classically there is no kinetic energy, so which is weighted by this potential energy. So now what I'm doing is simply a first year or second or third year statistical mechanics course. You have a potential energy, you have Gibbs factor, and you have to calculate correlation, average value of certain observables. So in particular, the force. What is the force? It is, in fact, this is the Coulomb force. This is the only force between the plates, which I've written here, derivative of the Coulomb potential, weighted by the two-point correlation function. This correlation function has one leg in slab B and one leg in slab A. Okay, that's a charge-charge correlation function. It is homogeneous in the y direction. The y direction is the direction along the surfaces of the plate. I think it's indicated here, and the x direction is the inhomogeneous direction. Okay, it is convenient to go to Fourier transform form of this formula, and then you have the so-called structure factor for this system in the Fourier vast static structure factor. There is no frequency because it's pure equilibrium, and now. The problem is to extract the d dependence from this formula. D comes at several places because the two slabs are separated by d, so we integrate in configuration space of particle at two different places. But also there is the joint interaction of particle into slabs which enter the constitution of the correlation function. So this is an amusing problem to find this function, because you have two metallic plates, macroscopic metallic plate, or maybe classical in this case, and you ask at the level of macroscopic physics, what is the induced fluctuation, force by fluctuation by the Coulomb interaction between these macroscopic plates? So what are the techniques? The techniques are standard techniques of classical statistical mechanics. In fact, we will use cluster expansion in the form of Meyer diagrams. So the Ursell function is nothing else than the two-point correlation function up to the densities, and we have the Meyer bond. So probably everybody has been through these techniques at some point. There is one problem to consider seriously, that is, but this is always true in Coulomb system, that the potential is not integrable at infinity, but one knows how to do to deal with this problem, because one can make a partial summation, which is the chain summation, which leads us to an effective potential, which is a Debye-Uckel potential. It is in quantum situation, it is the equivalent of a random phase approximation. Exactly. So instead of using the bare Coulomb potential, one make partial summation, we'll use the screen potential, which is itself well behaved at large distances. It obeys the Debye-Uckel equation, and it defines a screening length as usual. And this screening length is now inhomogeneous because it depends on which plates you are, if you are in between the plates or not. Okay, but you have all these objects well defined. And I will not enter how you sum all the diagrams and reconstitute the correlation functions. This is boring, and but that is a kind of a routine work. But just I will focus on the two physical ingredients that will lead to the result. So we have these two plates, and now we have this effective Debye-Uckel type potential. If the plates get separated, how does this potential behave? Because two plates are coupled by Coulomb interactions. So if you do it's useful to, well, I've maybe didn't mention that, it's useful to use a dimensionless Fourier variable where you take the original one divided by the distance, d, between the plates. And maybe you don't even have to read the formula, but you can look at the drawing. If you have, this is the Debye-Uckel potential between the two plates. And if you go to large separation, this splits into two individual Debye potential for each plate. That is more or less expected, because if two plates are very far away, they are independent of each other. But at what speed? The speed is 1/d. And in fact, the two pieces are two, in fact, that you find here are two Debye-Uckel potential. I put an index not to refer that they belong to individual slabs now and not to the coupled slabs. And in fact, they represent the interaction between any charge in the medium with a boundary charge on the surface at the boundary of the slab. So they're the same mathematical structure as the previous one, but now they live in each individual slab. That's the first. So there is a factorization of the potential at speed 1/d. The second point, which is very important and which is the root of universality, is the electroneutrality sum rules. Now, you know, for at the moment, so to speak, I've not said that we have conductors. Now, this will be implemented by the requirement or the fact, which can be proven in many, many model situations, that if you fix one charge, the red one, in a conducting media, it's screened by a screening cloud of opposite charges that makes the total charge, the one that you have plugged in, plus the screening charge equal to zero. That is, in fact, the system screens any charge that you put in, and this reduces, in fact, the range of the Coulomb potential, the effective Coulomb potential in the system. So this occurs here. I mean, in a dielectric, this will not occur, but that's really this equation, that's the two-point function, in fact, with the density. You R prime labels the particle in the screening cloud. You put the charge of the particle in the screening cloud and sum over to total charge in the green screening cloud. And this should be given, this should give exactly minus the charge that you have put in.
Systems,
it's very, very general.
Including dielectrics, all systems.
All systems where you have mobile charge if you have strict dielectric with all charge abound, I mean that's a different situation.
But surely it still has to be true microscopically of the exchange and correlation.
Yeah, but this is a microscopic. You see, really. This screening rule can be established in many, many ways. It's true if you do simply the bihuckel theory of the bulk system. It can be derived from the BGY hierarchy of correlations. It's also in great generality, provided that you have an homogeneous fluid electronic state.
Because it's normally built in deliberately to density functions, for example, you're trying to create holes, and it's even for insulators.
Okay, let's discuss that later. But at least for conductors, it has to be true. So you see, this is an integral relation that wash out all details of the, so to speak, of the correlation function, because it gives just a number here, and that will be the root of universality in this system. So, in this model, purely classical model, you do what I've done, what I've said to be done, and you find the 1.8. So the classical model reproduces correctly the general result. This is not of a surprise for two reasons. First, the long distance was classical because there was no H-bar, so we can suppose that there is an underlying microscopic model that does the job. In fact, it does. But let me discuss a little bit why the photon would disappear, the effect of photon of retardation or of the transverse part of the electromagnetic field would disappear at high temperature. Now, this is contained in the famous Bohr von Leeuwen theorem, because the theorem says that classical matter in thermal equilibrium decouples from the transverse part of the electromagnetic field in the radiation gauge. Why is it so? The theorem is so elementary that I cannot resist giving a proof, because you see, everything is classical now. So if you calculate in equilibrium the partition function, you have to integrate on phase space. The R integral is in finite box first, but the P integral, all energies are permitted, so runs from minus infinity to plus infinity. So perform first the P integral, momentum integral. But at fixed R, you can simply make a shift of the variable. This costs nothing. A disappears, and you are left with a partition function that doesn't depend on the vector potential. In fact, that is the reason why there doesn't exist classical diamagnetism. So what happens in the Casimir situation? When you, that may be heuristic now, but if you go to higher temperatures, the system tends to be more and more classical. I mean, in the infinite temperature limit, everything becomes classical. So the Bohr von Leeuwen, so to speak, start applying better and better. And in fact, in the strict limits for the dominating term, it applies fully. I mean, the Casimir effect becomes dominated by pure electrostatic force, as I have shown you in the pure classical model. So it's not a surprise that this result is purely classical.
You have to call out spin.
Ah, good question. I have not taken a talk. I will comment now about spins just in a second, because in fact I could finish here, but I would just give you an idea of the techniques, how to deal with a fully quantized model, because after all, it's quantum electrodynamics, it's not trivial. First, in the Hamiltonian, to answer now your question, in the Hamiltonian that I've presented before, I've not put in the Pauli coupling of sigma point dot B of spins with the magnetic field, which should be there, certainly. This is for simplicity, to some extent, but also one can convince oneself that this effect will be very, very tiny. That is, they will have a factor, a prefactor. In fact, you know, the ratio of electric quantity to magnetic, or maybe the converse, magnetic to electric quantity as a relativistic one of C square or C. So in fact, the spin effect will be to have a dimensionless parameter. Nc carries the rest mass of particles and beta the temperature. So they will have factor of this type. You can convince yourself that all spin effect will be. And these factors are negligible. I mean, at room temperature, this number is very immense. But that's right. To have a completely unquestionable proof, one has to add spins of the electrons. Now, to treat the full quantum electrodynamical model, one wants to mimic what was presented to you for the classical model. And a way to do that is to use functional integral representation of the objects. You know, functional integral equation, how place operators by commuting quantities that looks classical. So we have two types of degrees of freedom. We have first the field. And now you can read or not, but those who know how to construct the bosonic functional integral knows that one can use coherent state representation that diagonalize the annihilation operator of photons. And from that, one can represent the Gibbs factor matrix element between coherent state of the field as a functional integral on all on classical amplitudes with a Gaussian weight, which I've not, which is here. And the Hamiltonian is replaced by an Hamiltonian that has a classical vector potential, which is written here, where the annihilation and creation operator are replaced by classical time or imaginary time-dependent amplitudes. So that is kind of rather standard transformation. So the first thing to do is to have the field classical-like. Of course, this Hamiltonian still depends on the particle that are quantum, so non-commuting variables, so I need the chronological order here. But next thing is to make the particle look like classical. And that's also known technique. You use the so-called Feynman-Katz Itô representation, where the Gibbs factor for particles now in a potential are given by a Feynman or Feynman-Katz, because it's imaginary time integral over, this is a so-called Brownian bridge, this is a simply Brownian motion. I think one knows this formula, this is the effect of the potential. And the field here enters as the flux of the magnetic field around one of these Brownian loops, which I have drawn here. So we have now, in this image, if we do that on our full Gibbs states for many particle system, which is a bit more heavy, but exactly the same ideas, the system looks, the system of quantum point charge looks as a system of random Brownian filaments. You can think as a random wire, electrical wire, and with a magnetic flux through it, which is given by the loop, I mean the curve integral of the potential vector along this loop. So you have the system which is only classical-like objects. So you can think now as the phase space being first only labeled by positions is now labeled by, for a quantum particle, by a position and an internal degree of freedom, which is its quantum fluctuation, its loop. It's intrinsic, because you see, lambda is a de Broglie length, so lambda is proportional to h bar, so lambda, h bar, in fact, is a measure of the extension of this fluctuation. So you have an enlarged phase space, and then you can you can copy, so to speak, what we have done and use the same techniques as were used in the classical model. So I'm almost through. But there is one point that I would like to emphasize here, because you can ask me where quantum mechanics has disappeared. So what are you doing now? Now, I claim that the system of loops and random fields is isomorphic to the original quantum mechanical calculation. But where is the difference? The difference is essentially there. The Coulomb potential between two of these loops. So we have two random loops, and we have, of course, the Coulomb potential between the bits, the element of the loops. And we have inherited from the Feynman-Katz-Itô formula the so-called equal time prescription. That is, the two loops are run in time with the same time parameter s. This has the effect that two quantum particles in this language do not interact like classical particles. See, if you would think of two wires, each element of electric charge along the wire would interact pairwise with each other. That's classical physics. But in fact, those are missing in quantum mechanics. And that has a tremendous influence on the physics. Why? Because let's do just the following observation. Correct the quantum form to have the classical one to the expense of subtracting something. The something is simply, this is the equal time, I put a delta function, minus one. So this is an identity. Now, ELEC is just a classical-like interaction. So if we were to replace in the whole formalism, we have to forget about W, this would be a classical system of maybe kind of strange constitution, but it's really an assembly of classical electrical wires. But there is this W quantum mechanically. And this W, if you take the large distance behavior, it behaves like a dipolar interaction, which is more or less clear. That is, it is not so appropriate to think of quantum particle, point particle, as point charge. It's much more appropriate to think of them as fluctuating multiples. As a consequence, there are intrinsically multipolar forces in the quantum system that are not present in the classical system, and that changes the nature of screening and decay of correlation in the quantum system. In fact, Debye-Huckel theory never holds in a quantum system at large distances, because it is always dominated at very long distances by the fluctuating dipoles. So all forces, even in a high temperature system of electrons, are of van der Waals type, even for point particles. So after this remark, we are almost at the end. Now, since the model is quantum, we have to deal with the transverse part of the field. But that's easy, you know, in a sense, because the beautiful fact of the Feynman-Katz-Itô formula is that the magnetic field enters linearly, like a phase, contrarily to the original quantum system. You remember that the amplitude of this field are weighted by a Gaussian measure. So Fourier transform of a Gaussian is a Gaussian, not more to do. This could not be done at this level. This can only be done when you have, go to the Feynman-Katz representation. So you do that, you can. That means that you can integrate out exactly all degrees of freedom of the field. And this leaves you a pairwise loop-loop potential, which I call magnetic potential. It is, I don't write the formula because it's a little bit boring and heavy, but physically it is exactly like an ampere current-current interaction between these random loops. So when we have done that, we are in fact conceptually true, but maybe not mathematically, but because what do we have? We have the purely classical part of this interaction between the loops, the quantum part, this dipolar part that I was mentioned before, and we have also the magnetic potential, which is also dipolar. So we have a classical system now in which classical-like, I would say, I mean, structurally classical, in which we have this more complicated potential. And then you go with the machinery of Maya graphs and all that as before. In fact, you can resum the chains and have a kind of quantum mechanical Debye potential, and you have to deal with the purely quantum parts, blah, 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 and so on, and you find the result I have mentioned. So that's kind of...
Is there a cancellation between these three parts there? I mean, that you can point out?
Where? Cancellation between?
Between the upper three parts. That some, you mentioned one was classical.
This one?
This one, yeah. Is this then given before result and the other two cancelled?
I understand your question. Yeah, in fact, when you redo all this analysis, you rightly mention that, in fact, this comes from here, because that was the it was so in the classical model that was coming from the screen Debye potential. Now you may ask about the role of that. One can show that in the long separation limit, this is of order, high order in DC, 1 or D, I don't remember, D4, D5, or starts much later. And I think it doesn't contribute also. Yeah. No. So, in fact, the Bohr von Leuven theorem manifests now technically in the fact that these quantum parts do not survive the high temperature limit. Okay? And now, universality, I mean, the fact that the coefficient is independent of everything, follows again from the screening rule in the space of loop. We have this wiggling loop, but also they screen each other, exactly like classical particle. And that's the same mechanism. So I just finish by a few questions on which one might like to work, although maybe they are difficult. First of all, how to deal with the other regime in the microscopic model? That's quite, it's not an easy thing. It's not just that you, because if you go to ground state, you have to take into account the ground state property of the metal, so the ground state wave function of the metal, and who knows explicitly what it is. I mean, it is, so may, then there might be a way through. Well, we are just a little bit working on it.
Distance is large compared to the microscopic distances of the metal, which is still short compared to the...
To go technically according to these lines is not so... Now, a question. So we have seen that in the asymptotic limit of large separation, there is this debate between 1/4 and 1/8, and now we claim 1/8 is correct. If we lower the temperature, what happens? Do we believe that the zero temperature Casimir formula is right or not? After all, because in the metals at zero temperature, there are no thermal fluctuations, but there are quantum mechanical fluctuations. What?
Yeah. All of your results is based on the system that you have not responding to magnetically at finite temperatures.
No. In the full model, if I were able to calculate at any finite temperature.
No, but once you did the averaging over the fluctuating field, the effect of the uniform field would completely disappear. So I think your results are also in your model, for example, you would predict no magnetic field, there is magnetoconductance, that none of this would be present for your calculations at finite temperature.
Why? Because I've done nothing. I mean, I started with the Hamiltonian, and I've calculated a quantity which pertains only... I've calculated the free energy of all degrees of freedom. That contains everything. Even if I, as an intermediate state, make a partial average on photons.
But the heart of, I think, the calculation is this formula that you wrote, e to the minus beta p minus a squared being equivalent to e to the ia. And then when you average over a, the effect of the part of the field that is proportional to a will disappear.
No, but then it is contained in this effective. I've not written the formula for this effective loop-loop interaction. But this contains H bar, this contains the full information.
But it does not respond
to the information. Ah, no, but I could add, ah, yeah, also, I see what you mean, but there is no. What happened?
Why does it put that in?
Well, anyway, in the P minus EA, I only wrote the thermalized part of the part that is going to be thermalized with the matter. But I could add A plus A external, and then make the whole response theory of the system.
No, but then at the point where you do the averaging, that A uniform, that A external will disappear.
Not in quantum mechanics. I mean, if I have finite temperature, the Bohr, and so I'm really quantum mechanical, the Bohr von Leeuwen theorem doesn't apply. It applies only for strict classical matter. No, I don't think so. The Bohr von Leeuwen theorem, well, there will be a type of these effects. I mean, if I take everybody quantum mechanical, the Bohr von Leeuwen is not apparent. I mean, not operative. Or I don't. And I think.
Is all this really relevant to the limitless four versus magnetic path that you're mentioning? Is that likely to be involved in this? Because I don't think it's in any of these theories.
Try control F. Yeah.
Okay. I think.
Full screen.
You only see the effect of the coordinates, but not the momentum.
No, I don't agree.
Maybe.
In the original formulation.
In the original, I mean, if you take the original Hamiltonian,
right.
If everybody is quantum mechanical,
yes.
I mean, photon fields and momentum operators and all that. There is no way to simplify this, and you cannot make this subtraction formula used. No, I am. It works only classically, because in fact, quantum mechanically, you see, PR is a quantum mechanical position operator of the particle. They do not commute. So this is not a simple number that you can shift out of an integral anymore. And then you have to go through the whole thing. Man. And you
1/4 versus 1/8 is the very high temperature.
Yes, very high, very high. But if you have any given temperature,
yeah.
You must deal with the full thing. And we don't know how to, of course, probably it's not possible because it's just simply quantum electrodynamical calculation, but.
You also don't worry about the Pauli principle probably because of high temperature.
I do worry. But I skipped that. In fact, you can modify the space of loops by including Fermi statistics. That's possible, and so you can deal with Fermi statistics for the electron in the same formalism.
And you get the same result.
And I get the same results. But of course, what at large distances the main part. Electron in two different slabs would not fill the Fermi statistics. But in the slab.
Probably it's just the high temperature when you
yeah.
see the Boltzmann table.
So, just to finish the open problems. Yeah, I think one should, in the light of this consideration, if you accept them, I mean, one, it raises the question why the thermal fluctuation become less and less important when you lower the temperature, and why is it that for the standard Casimir effect at zero temperature, you can really deal with dead conductor? Why? I don't know really why.
Funnily, why the experiments are pointing to the other direction.
Because in you have quantum fluctuation of electrons in the wave function of the ground state, and why do they don't modify the Casimir coefficient? It seems that it is in Lifshitz theory goes into that direction, but from a microscopic view, of course, it would be nice to have the first non-universal temperature, which will include maybe conductivity effect by going to the next terms, but it's hard work. I insist that in this calculation, dissipation, conductivity, everything is contained because all the interactions are there, but not in an explicit manner, so to speak. So this raises the question how to make contact with the Lifshitz theory, because you don't have, I mean, it's a kind of black box. You don't have a direct constant function with you in this calculation.
Well, one way in which you do make contact with Lifshitz, I mean, apart from the factor of 4 versus 8, you've shown that in any finite temperature at large enough separation, there's no retardation, which sounds surprising at first, but I believe it. I agree with you. And in fact, the Lifshitz-type formulation at sufficiently high temperature reduces to the zero pole, what do they call those poles, thermal poles? Matsubara poles. It reduces only to the zero Matsubara poles, which of course evaluates everything at zero frequency, and it doesn't see retardation. So you're agreeing in that respect.
But I would like, we would like to have more physical contact. I mean, I know.
One thing puzzles me about this is that apart from the assumption of a local phenomenological dielectric function, the Jelashinsky formulation of the Lifshitz way of doing things appears to me to have exactly all the physics that your formulation has. And I agree that maybe it lies somewhere in having made those local approximations. But apart from that, I mean, it's finite temperature, anybody quantum.
Okay, maybe we can. You can show me.
It makes exactly the same approximation. It makes the random phase approximation. I'll show you the diagrams in the paper, which are equivalent to your choice of resummation of Inaya. Everybody seems to make the random phase approximation.
I mentioned that I made the bicycle or random phase calculation for sake of pedagogy, but we can show that all the non-bicycle diagram, we can include them and they don't contribute.
I'd be very careful saying that.
In
systems, it's just not true.
Okay.
But chemical systems, two molecules, absolutely untrue. If you do take RPA for all interactions, you get quite wrong coefficients.
Yeah, but we don't, in fact. It depends on what you are calculating, but
if you want the coefficient in front of that may very well be wrong. That's a separate issue.
Yeah, okay. And just to mention that the formalism is not wrong, I mean. That is, with this effective magnetic potential, we could retrieve all the retardation effect of Casimir-Polder type. I mean, in the atom with a wall or two atoms in van der Waals forces, exactly with the exact numerical coefficients. So it's another way of doing this retardation problem.
Question for you or anyone else. Have some people proposed that it's the non-locality of the dielectric response that's responsible for this?
I think some people have tried using non-dielectric.
The only thing I can see that in which the Jelashinsky-Lifshitz approach really fundamentally differs from you, in that they, right from almost from the outset, they make these.
Yeah, but anyway, you are. Even if you are more sophisticated with the dielectric function, you have to make a model of this dielectric function to go on.
Yes. Well, I mean, you don't have to make the local approximation, you can make the RPA approximation for it.
You can do a lot of things, but I'm sure. But the point is, was to have a non-questionable answer on a very small part of the theory, because one has to, it's a complementary principle, one is exact on a very small part, but one.
I agree with what you said about the I'm just wondering how one can make it come out of the Jelashinsky theory, and the Achilles heel might be that local approximation.
Mm-hmm.
So this Jelashinsky theory gets one quarter?
I don't know which it gets.
Of course,
it comes back to
Lifshitz. So Lifshitz is only one quarter.
But it's not conceptually different from Lifshitz theory.
No, it's just a nicer one.
It's just a reformulation.
It's basically the same answer in the end as Lifshitz. It's a high fixed.
And you will take up. I mean,
No. You multiply power frequency zero part, that's it. And when you are back, when you are back in classics.
But does it agree? Does it agree with physics when you do that? I think it helps.
Well,
it does. It does. Okay. It gets the four of the eight.
Yeah.
Okay.
For Drude, yeah.
Oh, for Drude, that's the point. I mean, so somehow the putting in of a phenomenological tower, a relaxation time, which gives you Drude, possibly these other papers, which I think I've seen myself actually, that claim it's to do with non-locality, they're both things to do with the matter. Somehow I think a reconciliation between those.
The point is, if you put in Drude, in, I mean, any variant of Drude, in the Lipschitz formula, you get this 1/8. I think that's
yeah.
I mean, whether you have a plasma frequency tail or not, that doesn't matter.
Well, if you go through these anecdotically large separations, what matters is only how the dielectric response diverges.
That's
the Drude peak.
Yeah.
That's what you need. I don't know why you should bother about plasma.
Yeah.
But being a Lipschitz person here, as opposed to a Casimir's person, and being an experimentalist who measures epsilon, instead of someone who would say, I need a model for epsilon, I would say, I just go determine it for the materials I'm interested in. Then actually we know in Lipschitz that transitions all the way up to 30 electron volts play a big role in determining the Lipschitz interaction energy, and that's exactly the plasma frequency, they're typically 20 to 25 electron volts. And just saying that everything thins down to the Drude or to a perfect metal, fictitious metal, you know, is missing all of the rich details of real materials.
Yeah, but he looks at just astronomically large separation.
Yeah, yeah, it's, yes.
And it's maybe not a very practically relevant limit, but this limit, it is the Drude.
It does go down to the frequency.
I agree, in practice, you need...
It's a spectral half that. It's really linked to the Matsubara frequency zero part.
Mm-hmm.
This is a classical part.
So typically, what is alpha for room temperature? Sorry, for alpha to be much bigger than the one.
In room temperature, in experimental situation, alpha corresponds to the regime of small distance and small temperature. So alpha is very, very small. Very, very large. Sorry.
At room temperature, the De Broglie wavelengths of photons is roughly 7 microns.
Yeah.
So the measurements are below that. So
it's really definitely not. No, I am on the moon here. I mean, on the moon compared to that.
Yeah, but I mean, there are differences in. In Moadine's talk, I mean, he compared. Of course, this was working at different frequencies, but the Drude models or the input using for the semiconductors using the Drude input gave systematically wrong answers, right? I mean,
that was.
Now, for semiconductors with finite conductivity.
Zero temperature. Lipschitz formula agreed very, very experiment, and that is what you would expect because the separations are so small compared to the De Broglie wavelengths, and that was important. But the Drude, I'm not sure if that was maybe a problem with the spectral data they put into the Lipschitz. Yeah, I was a bit confused. I think at the beginning you had the transparency, there was this, you made the remark that if you had finite temperature and you would apply macroscopic boundary conditions, I think that's what was the term you used, you would get incorrect results.
Maybe it's a too strong statement, but...
It's at finite temperature at all, or...
No. I don't claim that Lipschitz is wrong at finite temperature. Mm-hmm. I claim that boundary condition.
The standard Casimir calculation is wrong.
Casimir time was wrong. It's definitely wrong at any finite temperature.
Okay. Yes.
So you're saying that if you represent the field as a collection of harmonic oscillators, and then just apply equipartition theorem to each of them, and then see what the result, that you will not get the right path. You will not get minus 1 a, you will get minus 1 quarter. Is what you're saying?
Yeah. Very first transparency.
Just the boundary condition, you mean it's just that the field is zero at the...
Exactly. The tangential field is zero on the surfaces. That cannot be physically correct when the temperature is not zero.
You're happening in two modes and two boundary conditions.
Right.
There's a Dirichlet layer, there's a Neumann. So effectively, if you're having one of the modes a day, which in this case is the Neumann, then you get the right answer. So the question is...
My expectation was that this, whether it's right or wrong, should be just a consequence of all the equipartition theorem, because there was no any reference in the answer in the model. But you're saying if I just apply naively equipartition theorem to the standard macroscopic boundary conditions, I will not get the right answer.
Well, in the purely classical theorem, the first major difference between finite and zero temperature is that at finite temperature, the plasma, which is supposed to create this perfect boundary condition, has a finite Debye length.
In
other words, non-responsive. So I think fundamentally, somehow, I think the tau business, the Drude business, is also related less directly to non-locality. I strongly believe that.
Yeah, maybe it's obvious, but I probably didn't get the point. You mentioned somewhere at the beginning that the difference, this one factor 1/2, is in the fluctuations of the particles, probably the charge-carrying particles, this statement, inside the conductors. Mm-hmm. Where have you now shown that one? I mean, at this point...
It's simply a kind of logical deduction that if the conductor are mathematical surfaces or are dead... And if you treat them as living, you have this factor 1/2 of difference. So compared to the treatment of dead conductor, one has to conclude that fluctuation of matter contribute for 1/2. I mean, that's all. I mean, it's maybe not very deep.
It's not quite clear to me. Is it not that also the photons can go inside the conductor, things like this?
They can. In the model, they can. I mean, the field is everywhere.
Well, because you can't distinguish the photons that are causing the interaction between the two systems.
No.
And the photons which are causing the response inside each system, which must be...
Right. I mean, our calculation is like a black box. I mean, you have E minus beta H, and you extract an information which is supposed to be true. But then if you would like to analyze it in physical bits, I mean, it becomes difficult. I mean, that's a price to be paid.
I mean, this is probably a contradiction. If you have a superconductor or something like this, or two superconductors...
Because this is low temperature and...
That's probably...
You see, basically, the Feynman-Katz integral is well devised for high temperature, for non-zero temperature, because when you go to low temperature, the quantum fluctuation dominate and the loops, the wiggling of the loops become enormous, and then the mathematics break out here.
Okay. I mean, you don't have a more precise point than that, pointing to the difference between what 4.8 what would go wrong if you do it in the naive way.
What do you mean in a naive way?
Yeah, I mean just sort of the boundary conditions.
No, I am puzzled. Is there a back of an envelope argument why it's just a modification 1/2? It's 1/2 is not it's a rather special number. It's not point. And this I would like to find, but I couldn't find.
Not something stupid like throwing away the momentum of the electromagnetic field.
If you do the calculation, you find the difference, but just explaining in words, I don't know. Yeah.
And how important is the choice of gauge for this computation? Because if you take the radiation gauge,
this is a radiation gauge.
I don't think you have charges, right? Because delta A is proportional to the It's proportional to the
charges.
The charges.
maybe that's
and if delta is zero.
You don't have the Coulomb term as well. It's all in there, right?
It's all in there.
There's no separate Coulomb term, right? It's all in the field operators. Is that right?
What do you miss at this point?
I'm just wondering, yeah. Because you're choosing delta A to be zero, you can have no local charges.
So the radiation gauge, by imposing that, it separates, I mean, it separates the Coulomb part from the transverse parts. I mean, you can always, if you're a vector field, you can always decompose it in a longitudinal and transverse parts. And it's what's done here explicitly.
No, I agree with you. I think there's a genuine problem here.
What?
I mean, for example, with this Jerlachinsky approach, the other one way that I just recall it differs from is it uses a different gauge in which everything's in the A field. You don't need a Phi field at all, and so presumably you don't need that explicit Coulomb term. And then the same argument, which sounds right to me, would tell you that all interactions are zero.
No, but
not just
you can use any gauge you like. I mean,
and the Van Leeuwenhoek will still be true, presumably.
Yes, but
everything's another.
No, but I agree. But you can. You write the Hamiltonian is not gauge invariant. It takes different forms in different gauge.
Mm-hmm.
Now you have to make a choice to start the calculations. But I claim that if any of us is able to calculate in another gauge where this animal looks completely different.
Mm.
The result for physical quantity should be the same at the very end.
By using another gauge, you don't just throw away the Coulomb term, and the whole thing starts.
No, you can use the Lorentz gauge, which is relativistically fully invariant, but it's not convenient here because we don't use the Dirac equation here. We use, Schrödinger.
A nice free field energy. I mean, that's also.
I mean, if you look in the book of Cohen Tanuji and collaborators, which is entirely devoted of interaction of non-relativistic matter and photons, that's their starting point.
Want to worry also about ghosts? Then.
Calculation in different gauge would be very difficult because here at least it disentangle the photons from the Coulomb in an explicit way mathematically. But I agree, one can take any gauge you like in your office, I mean.
So where is A0? I'm not sure.
A0?
So you take the...
A0 is integrated out, it's in the Coulomb.
Oh, yeah. That's I see what you mean. If you take the Lorentz gauge, you have on the same footing the quadrivector A, and then A naught as longitudinal photon that mediates the Coulomb interaction. This could be written in this way, but if you use this gauge, this is, so to speak, the effect of A naught, I mean, which is now give the Coulomb form in explicit terms, right?
One generalize somehow your approach to calculate the response that you would have. Let's say you have an infinite slab of your material,
yeah.
An impinging TE field, whether there is a reflection of finite temperature.
As soon as I am out of equilibrium, that is, I have to calculate propagation in real time, I think things. I'm not sure if
steady
a steady state. Okay.
It's still a response.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah,
it's still
maybe.
A response function and not the ground state.
Yeah,
in terms of what you're doing. So
you have a steady. So you would add, so to speak, an external standing wave here. Yeah. If it starts from anything that starts from e minus beta h, and enables to use Feynman-Katz and functional integration, one can do a lot of problems.
As soon as you have a time-dependent external field.
No, that doesn't work.
Strictly for equilibrium.
It's strictly, I mean, the technique works strictly for equilibrium. As soon as you have time-dependent, real-time-dependent correlation function, it's another business. I mean, I have nothing to say about that. It's much more difficult.
Okay, so zero temperature, the quantum argument, but the classical argument.
Still,
because it applies to thermal equilibrium. As soon as you apply external electromagnetic field, that's a time-dependent perturbation.
But what kind of problem do you have in mind if we add a standing wave?
Well, I want to see whether for your system RT is zero or not.
Ah, okay.
So to apply that level, you would need a thermal equilibrium radiation field coming, not a particular frequency and time dependence. So then, presumably, you might have it appear to be transparent, but it's because it is balanced inside and out thermally. But the problem of a particular EM field with a particular omega and K coming in onto the surface is not coverable, I'm sure, by that time.
Good question. I don't know if it's possible to do that in the framework of pure equilibrium. If one can formulate the problem in those terms, I think one can answer according to this technique.
You can calculate lots of response functions.
Oh, yes, sure.
From closed equilibrium.
Yeah?
Response.
Yes.
Response uses all the excited states if you expand that. I mean, technically, expectations in equilibrium are the Kubo formula, but they contain the time, which means that again, you put an intermediate set of states in the middle of the Kubo formula, it involves all the excited states, which is in fact a common line calculator.
Now, but maybe using linear response and fluctuation dissipation arguments, one can. Answer your question from pure equilibrium calculations.
The solid state people generally do take that.
No, I think there is a lot to do, but one has to ask the right questions, because of course calculations are difficult because there are so many. I mean, it's not just. I would be very happy if next days or weeks some suggestion about calculation that could be performed, which would be physically relevant with this and deciding about some question.
And you are also not worried about this NERNST business because...
I'm not worried about NERNST, because what is NERNST theorem in this framework?
You're a high temperature, right?
No. Anyway. The NERNST theorem in quantum mechanics is to know if there is a single ground state or at least a multiplicity of ground state which has not degenerate proportional to the volume. So the mathematical question of NERNST theorem in this framework is completely decoupled from my calculation. It is to know if this Hamiltonian has a unique ground state. That's a mathematical question well posed. People do not know at the moment, I mean, at least in sure mathematical terms. And that's, if there is one, NERNST theorem is always valid, and there's nothing to do with this discussion, with the discussion of the Casimir force, in my feeling.
So, I mean, if you don't get the NERNST theorem, it just means you calculate it wrong.
If I don't get the NERNST theorem, it poses a deep theoretical question. I mean, why the Hamiltonian of matter doesn't fulfill the NERNST law? I mean, that doesn't lead to the NERNST theorem. That would be a separate question, which is certainly deep and important, but it's not to do with Casimir forces. So I am very confused about this discussion on NERNST theorem in the literature on Casimir. I think, for me, they are not relevant to the question.